Okay, let's start it. Today, I hope you're excited. Like, I'm dragging everything to today. I said, today I'll tell you why do we need a fields. So, everything we say is why do we need a field, why are the field good? Well, you know what do we do with it from dance course, and I will talk more about what we're going to do with it next week. Okay, this first reaction should really be, because we've been to last lecture, we had a quantum theory and the special relativity quantum theory, so why not fields? What's wrong with not having fields? So that's the first bullet point I want to make. Well, the answer is basically to this question is life is too hard without the fields. And for the rest, for a while, I'll show you why life is too hard. So before that, I want to mention, so we started with a quantum mechanics system. And we say, let's impose special relativity onto it. What do we get? I just want to do a summary of what we have before and see how each individual piece is trying to say, look, just made the field. So the first piece is first week. First week, we are persuaded that we have a basis of states. N is the species of the particle. And from now on, we'll add a little vector because it's free. Free particle, if we know the spatial momentum, we can compute the energy. That's all I meant. So we only need three independent momentum. Okay. The next thing is what we learned yesterday is that there is a Hamiltonian field. It needs to be Lorentz invariant. And then the next thing we brought up is not only it needs to be Lorentz invariant, it also have this commutator needs to vanish space-like. And the last point is about the CDP. So as we get a dirt 4 sum of momentum for each vertex. So all your, by vertex I meant the interacting Hamiltonian, what do we call it, V. So this is so far what we learned. If you start with a quantum theory, and you want to integrate a special relativity, you'd better follow the first three rules, and you should also follow CDP. And we'll see how these will impact us today. So let me go back to the question, why not fields? Well, the point we're going to use is point number two. Says Hamiltonian field needs to be Lorentz invariant. And this is really the answer of why not field. So remember, so if my goal is to show the Hamiltonian is going to be Lorentz invariant, I should use what the Hamiltonian is, which Weinberg tells us is it's a series of creation annihilation operator. I'm following one of your feedback. I'm just telling you the story before I do computations. So from here, I want to know it contains some A dagger A stuff. And I should know how A dagger A transform, and to, if I want to make argument that that thing is Lorentz invariant. And to figure out what's A, how A dagger A transform under Lorentz transformation, I should know how the states transform under Lorentz transformation. So we go back to week one. Yeah, because A dagger, this is schematic, but A dagger is something like this. So if I know how this transform, and one other thing is vacuum, so I should be able to extract how the operator transforms. Is this big enough? No. Okay, I'll write bigger from now. This says Hamiltonian has a series of A dagger A, and A dagger is defined that way. Okay, so how is the state transform? I believe that's where last week that I lost the majority of the people, the little group argument. Yeah, so now I'm gonna show you a different proof. So it's not the same calculation. So even if you have it, it's nice to say it again, okay? If you understand the little group argument, very nice. But for the majority of the people, I'll make the argument again. So the argument, now I'm starting from a different angle to ask the question. So hopefully if the other angle is, I don't know, not understandable, and hopefully this one will be. So my starting point is I know if it's a little group member acting on Ks, it will give me the representation of the little group, i.e. the SU2 business. So this is my starting point. I know this. Because what you want to prove is like, what you want to prove is this thing. I think I'm writing bigger. This line, yeah? Okay, I'll try always write this line. Okay, so this is your two. You're acting another U on, you will be able to prove this thing is actually the representation of the little group. So last time we hold on to the opinion says, I want to get this, how can we tie it together with little group? And this time I'm holding to the point is that if we start there, can I get something? Okay, so this is my goal. The goal is to show this thing, and I'll call this a placeholder. I'm only writing these C's. C's is very general things. I have no idea what a C is. This is as good as a question mark there. So this is my goal. I have an initial state at acting on Lorentz transformation. The thing I know is it definitely changed my momentum. I don't mix with the other states. And how they mixed, I have no idea. Yeah? The next step is I'm going to use two definitions. They are the same definition. It says I can define this P of S as something K of S that get boost. So this is the definition of that. I define. Gave me a Ks and a boost, I can define the Ps. And that boost is very specific. It's in the notes and also doesn't look pretty. Okay, So if you agree with the left, I'm going to do exactly the same thing on the right. So the idea is I have no idea how to connect the state with PS or the state with lambda PS, but I can express them into this case. I like K is basically the rest momentum. Okay? There's no magic here. This is why I decided to do this computation again. This is no magic. I'm just following the logic. The logic is if I define the PS, I should use it. Yeah? Still okay? And the next thing, so why do I need this space holder? The next thing that I say is these are a bunch of space holders. It's not an operator. Okay? It's not an operator. This is the operator. See, there are two U's over here, one U over here. So if I want to get closer to my starting point, it's easy to get rid of this guy. I just want to get as close as possible to the thing I know. So now I'm going to take a U inverse of this particular thing to get rid of it. Okay, so now there is U inverse. And the rest, nothing happened to them. I'm just copying them down. Okay. So with some definition, take some inverse, I manage to turn my right-hand side, at least the states, look exactly like something I know. Now I just look at the right-hand side. I have a bunch of U's. If you know about representation, the representation multiplication should be equals to the group theory multiplication. That's why it's a representation. So I'll combine them. I simply take the U outside and combine all of them to provide this. Okay, the right hand side is the same. I have three representation of a group. I can combine them to become a representation of one group member. All I need is to multiply all the group member together. And that's where that weird looking thing comes. So now I will draw my little triangle again. So here's K. So we start at a K because I'm acting on a state of KS. And it takes a boost, which is called the LP, arrived at P. And then the next step is there is some lambda, Lorentz transformation, turn my P into lambda P. But no, look at that inverse. Brings me right back to the K because L is always a boost. L inverse is always a boost back to K. And you're like, wait, I didn't do anything. So which means whatever these three things, it achieve what the W achieve, which is not changing K. So I'm happily going to call this crazy bunch of three things W, because it is a W. W is by definition is whatever doesn't change K. is W. And now, see, look, that's exactly my first line. So it tells me this C, which is this placeholder, is just this. Except now the W is very complicated. It depends on lambda, it depends on P. So that's in the end why we claim U, claim P, S is given by this representation of the W, which is that so I hope this is a more logical derivation. Every line makes some sense. And if you combine to all the lines, you realize that is how our state transform. It's not pretty. So you can do this thing with W. You can try it with the lambda. But because of all this P, become lambda P, become lambda 2, lambda 1 P, they will never form a representation themselves. Okay, yes? Yes.
Could you explain again why they don't form a representation?
If you write down U lambda 2, U lambda 1, and you get U lambda 2, lambda 1, but now there's all this P1, P2, P, and the lambda 1, P, lambda 2, lambda 1, P, they should supposed to be constant. If you can, basically, if use W, you can understand what happens to the right-hand side as a matrix multiplication. But with lambda and P, you don't have that. You can't show it. I can try to show you that. Okay, yeah. I can show you, write it out. They just there. So like for this one, you are going to look. This is going to be small, but you're going to see something like this. And then you decided to say, aha, that looks like a matrix multiplication to me. So the other hand, the other side is going to too. So I can show you what it looks like when it is a representation. It's just the other one doesn't look like this. It has all this P really screw things up. Okay, so this is really still belongs to our discussion of the states. This is how a state transform. Okay. The key point is this thing is very complicated. That's really the key point. It's going to be very useful when you actually start to do some computation later. But at this moment, when we discuss why not a field, realize this thing doesn't look pretty and it's not a group element. This C's don't form a group is enough for us. Okay. And now I'm going to, that U lambda acting on PS will become that thing. This line I'm writing just to be a complete understanding and then not to forget about the translation. So I'm just saying, if you add the translation, well, that's easy to deal with. You just translate. And you pick up E. Okay. So what's the fuss? Well, now we have a Hall state transform. We can look at how our operator transform. And this is on the vacuum. So in this line, what happened is that I used the definition of a Dagger, which you have played with yesterday's tutorial, on Monday tutorial. Only thing is changing this day is whenever I see a state, I turn it into a creation operator acting on the vacuum. Okay, one more line. We're gonna finally arrive at the important line. The important line is I can write down how my a Dagger's transform. The most important property of this transformation is it doesn't transform well. I have all these W, but it depends on momentum and so on and so forth. I inserted a U inverse U. U act on vacuum, and I'll read it off as an operator thing. EX. Yeah.
What does J represent in the last three equations?
Huh?
What does J represent in the last?
Oh, okay, very good. J represents the spin J of SU2, because our W is the little group. The little group is SO3, which is returned to SU, related to SU2. So people normally says for a particle, it has a definite spin. Hence, we should have a knowledge of this J, and just right there. At this point, the J is not important. The J is important later today. Okay, so the point is X. This is how our operator transform. So I would like to write you a typical Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian has two A Dagger A. What that will look like? You have the sum over all the S. You have the integrator over all the DPs. That's what Weinberg wants us to do. And in the middle, you have this selected and not to mention our C's, this the coefficients of a particular term. Okay, the point is, so the typical Hamiltonian of the selected form has three A or A Daggers, looks like this. And now, three of those transform like that. You can see a pile of things coming out of this, and the problem is this do not form any representation. So good luck to find a coefficient that somehow cancel all the transformation from A's. So in practical, you can go through all the C's you want and it will show that maybe it will cancel that kind of transformation. But in practice, you're gonna take a long time for each of this term in Hamiltonian. So you should, from scalar field quantum field theory, you probably have something like lambda phi 4. You'd have like 16 terms or something, maybe less than that. But still, for each term, you have to look at all these A dagger and A's who transform bizarrely, not representation-like. And now it's the person who are working with the relativistic quantum mechanics to say, ha, I can find some coefficient. Exactly, transform the other way so that they together is Lorentz invariant. Tough life. I think people are working on it to find one, but not very successfully. Yep.
Gong, there, U minus one.
Yeah.
We can put it because like vacuum is invariant under Lorentz, but it's not, okay.
It's not a foolproof.
Sorry?
It's not a foolproof. We can't just cancel the vacuum. But it's more like we assume this, then the states transform as we expected.
Hinting on that, you mentioned that we should read out the coefficients, right? And U minus one is not there, but we just put it artificially because we like the form, right?
Well, yeah, because we know that the operator gets squeezed between left and the right things. U minus has to be there, otherwise it cannot be called a transformation.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah, that would be my rationale.
Okay.
It's not very rigorous. Okay. So this line says this transfer, these all transform with a bunch of junk. And good luck to somehow find something transform as junk inverse. Just doesn't work. So then we conclude life is too hard without a field. And then you can see, what's the motivation of field? Why does field doesn't run into this kind of problem, right? So the next thing is we'll provide you some motivation. The next bullet point I want to make is that I just have a sense that maybe we have field, we can solve this problem, this particular problem. There are other good things about a field to come today. But first, you encounter a problem, field is proposed to solve it. Okay, let's just suppose some field exist such that this thing depends on xt, which make it a field, and we're doing the Lorentz transformation as before, or Poincaré transformation as before. Okay, so this is how field transform. It used to be at x, and now it's at the lambda x plus a. And then when we talk about the field transformation, it's really how to relate the field at x and the field at lambda x plus a. And this is a proposed, maybe they'll be so nice as two that it's related this way with some presentation, with some representation. So the field transform in the representation of the Lorentz group. That's the hope. Okay, we'll get to how this is gonna work and why they exist and what the hell are they, this kind of cool questions. But now I just say, let's suppose it exists. Okay? And the key assumption is this only depends on the group element. There's no momentum anymore. Maybe that's why we like field. Just the numbers, the Lorentz transformation numbers needed. So the proposed calculation is you can insert a U lambda prime A prime over here, and then another U inverse lambda prime A prime over there. Then you basically did this transform twice. You can actually show that if you accept this assumed field exists and transform well under Lorentz, you can show these D's again, it has become a group, the representation of the group. So I'm not going to show you this calculation, but that can be done. You just do the transformation again, sandwich it with a U, U inverse again. This will pop out. Okay. It's nice. These are group representation of Lorentz group, which sort of like the representation of SU2. And these are the representation we know. So what's happening with Hamiltonian then? Well, compare the difference is that there's no integral over momentum anymore. There's no submission of a spin anymore. So first line caused some difficulty. Those difficulties are gone because we assume our field somehow doesn't depend on. The only field index carrying is being a representation of a Lorentz group. Okay, what is still left is some sort of discreted stuff. Yes. There's a question. Yeah.
So these they're like finite dimensional representations.
That's right. That's the ones we already learned. We know how to write down the finite representation. Because if you like at least for the quantum field theory we work with you get a field, you would know what the spin it is. And that spin will indicate how that D exactly looks. Okay, so now, I mean, okay, maybe it didn't look obviously simpler, but when these things transform, it spit out some known SU2 representation parameterized by constants. Maybe it's not obvious, but this is basically Clebsher-Gordan coefficients. Right? You have a field in this rep. You can see there are a bunch of fields, but they all transform as like a half rep when j equals half, j equals one, and you just need to sum all those spin and find the inverse spin to inverse it. So the idea is if you have the field, finding out g, which is some condensed notation that depends on all sorts of l, is actually doable. And that's what actually we're going to do in the second half of the course, is that giving a Dirac field, what kind of interaction can we write down? You can actually write down them easily. Yeah?
Sorry, I was confused. Why does the representation not perform any translations?
Okay. It turns out it doesn't depend on. But let me look it up why. Okay. That's a good question. I think I wonder about it. I'll get you an answer. Okay. So now you can see why we like fields, because they all transform with constants. We know how to combine those constants together, combine a half and a half, spin, then we'll get a spin one and spin zero, and all this process will enable us to actually write down this Hamiltonian, and it is Lorentz invariant. So the first question is really answered why we need a field. It's because we need to keep the Hamiltonian Lorentz invariant. In the relativity quantum theory carefully built on Monday, that's really tough. And then Weinberg says, if I want to write down a theory, I really just want to write down a generic theory like this, and not worry about details like how to find this coefficient to. This coefficient is going to have a horrible looking once you find it, as soon as you go beyond the scalar field. This is easy to do if you have a scalar field. Otherwise, it's horrible. And of course, you go through that horrible process. You have to say, wait, the coefficient doesn't look that horrible. There must be something underlies it. Happen to be field. Okay. So maybe the next thing I want to say is that, okay, build me a field. I have no field. In our theory on Monday, there's no field. And if you just say, let's also introduce a field in our theory, then it's not very savory. So the next bullet point I want to make is how to make field. But this point is much harder, but I just want to get it started. So field are some operators, as we know. So how do we make field? What do we have as operators in our system? Yeah. Creation and annihilation operator. That's all we introduce. States, creation and annihilation operator. Period. We have nothing else. So it must be made of creation and annihilation operator. The question is how? Right? You have this on the left, and then you have a bunch of annihilation operator on the right. You can build one for the creation operator too, but I'm going to build the annihilation field first. What do we do? What fits in the middle? This happens to us before. It's like, you know, you have a bunch of things, but they are just not the ones you're looking for. And what can you do with them to tweak them, to make them do our job? And so like we used to have a J1 and J2. They are not good letter operators. So what did we do to them? Let's do that. Take linear combinations, which means in this, you need to sum over S. Then you need to define some integral. This is my funny notation, but it really saves me a lot of time when I'm writing my lecture notes. This notation says that you will have the perfect Lorentz invariant, like this thing. So whenever I want to integral of this, I just write this. And most of the time, you don't even have to ever open it. It just perfectly cancel out with this part, perfectly cancel out with what you have in the creation annihilation commutator. So otherwise you will be seeing me just writing that like 100 times in the next few weeks. That just means we have integrated momentum, and which even being nice, we integrate them Lorentz invariantly. So at this point, okay, very good. We designed something, but what do we have as a coefficient? Let's call it a U. What should a U depend on if there is a coefficient?
S
and P. Otherwise, what are we summing over, right? Very good. So from the right-hand side, we say you got to depend on S to be summed over. You got to depend on P to integrate over. But look at the left. What else you should be dependent on?
X.
Otherwise, where did you get the X bit dependence? And there's a final layer index, L. Just by comparing index, you have many, many index, and it depends on many things. Okay, so that's what we're going to do. And there's going to be, okay, no, I can't do that because the other one actually have a different kind of coefficient. So there's going to be a chi. I call it X because I don't like a chi. X looks like X because this is a mysterious field. We haven't then restricted us to scalar field or Dirac field yet. It works for everybody. And you can write down a copy of this line. And the only thing you need to change is change your annihilation field to be the creation field and change your coefficient U to be V. And I'm not going to write it down. It's the same. And you change your field name to be like a plus. Okay. Maybe it's good to take the break since it's exactly 45 minutes. So I shouldn't resist that. And then I'll tell you some success of this field. We'll delay the ominous future of how to find a field to Friday. But it's going to be good to say that how successful it is.
When you construct field, we're just constructing it that way. Choose that way, and it doesn't need to be that form.
Well, kind of.
Or is it a unique a way to build a field?
Well, if it's basically, there's one sentence I forgot to say. It's an important one. Thank you. So after you get an annihilation field and a creation field, we're going to linear combine them. So that one will be the most general one. If you're varying why there is no field has A and A diagonal together, yes, there are. But the A's will build the field together, and then we do linear combination.
Okay.
So if you have the field, if you want to build a field, not using A, but using like a KA plus lambda A diagonal, totally, you can do that. So, because the linear combination making this construction actually general.
Any of us? What's coming?
Question. Can you please write a little bit bigger? Because
it becomes smaller.
Like from that right side.
Okay. Yes.
I used to have the problem writing too big. I never finished a topic. It's okay. I'm doing asymptotic series. So.
I think it's getting worse and worse. My left eye. My left eye can't see.
But I'm not sure, she said she was listening back to 7 till now.
Have you paid?
Yeah.
Back yesterday?
Yeah, and so on. I mean, I just took them into our office inside.
So,
I don't know. Some people said they're not coming. She just showed me what to do. I mean, she took them to the
No, come on.
Yeah, much
Yeah, I don't have a No one is.
Yeah,
it's gonna help.
It looks like that they really put some hunger challenge to put more
down.
And it's a race.
So sick.
I don't know if I'm going to perform.
So this is like on the way.
Okay, I'm gonna start, and the next bullet point is a success of field. Success of field. How successful is a field? I mean, the you can see the most important thing is if can we can solve for those U or V things, those coefficients. If we solve it, it means you can actually build a field. If you don't, you're like, okay, you're dreaming too big about the transform well thing. But let's just say they all worked out, living in a dream. How successful is field? And this first one is called the nod to CDP, because this one is easier to show. So remember what the CDP says is for each V has one delta, some sort of a momentum transformation, but there is only one. Otherwise, you get your S has a different number, and then that's not allowed by CDP. Okay, this one hopefully is not too bad to see. First, I'm going to make this claim because we have trust in momentum. The trust in momentum belief led us to believe that the U L, the x dependence is just a translation, so it's a plane wave. It's okay if you don't believe it. Later I'm going to show for it, later on Friday, okay? But have belief in this plane wave.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Sorry, what do you mean by NOD? The
sorry, not. Just.
Oh.
Just like, it works with CDP. You need. Okay, so here we go. It seems like we've been here before. I'm going to write it very generally. Is there some coefficient we don't care at right now? Some sum of the integrals, they are always there. Some volume integrals. What we have, I'm going to write one of them carefully, is this. Right? There's some coefficient that tells us that how the U's become field. But your field is basically a bunch of this, and I'll keep the plane wave part clear. Do you agree? There's a bunch of things I don't write down. But if you grab that field expansion, and there used to be A, and now we say we can write it as field, and you have this. At the end, you have a bunch of like A plus, A minus, whatever. Okay. We'll mess up my momentum sign, but the point is your expression for the interacting Hamiltonian will have a bunch of plane waves. Of course. Because if you claim the coefficient is a plane wave. So this H, remember, this H is some coefficient times a bunch of chi's. And those are the coefficients that you use the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient to figure out. And each of this field will give me some U, and there's some A. But now I said that the U coefficient always depends on a plane wave. So there are three plane waves if you start with three field, etc. I think three is fine. And now, I'm not going to do this computation because I don't know what are those dots are. But I claim I can do my space integral first. Remember we introduce our space integral first, integral in the first place because we don't want the time integral too lonely, so that we have Lorentz invariance. Okay, but you know perfectly what's this integral is going to give us. It'll give us that the momentum conservation required by CDP and no more dirt, because that's all our momentum factors. So the first point is, okay, at least the agree with cluster decomposition almost built in, agree with. So that's good. And the next one, will be solved a little bizarrely, which we'll see carefully on Friday. But now I'm just kind of waving. So remember all these things. We already solved the Hamiltonian is Lorentz invariant. We already said that CDP is good. So of course, we need to deal with the causality. That's the list of requirements given by special relativity. So this is what we want. Yes? Is the size okay? Okay. Okay, so how does field solve our problem here? Okay, so I guess I'll write it again. At x is some integral. Important thing is we have some u's. Okay, so that's the annihilation field. So what will be nice? How could we fulfill that if H is just bunch of chi minus and chi plus? The best case scenario is chi minus commute with chi plus. Chi minus is commuting with chi minus. Chi plus is commuting with chi plus. So if and only chi minus and chi plus commute, we solve all our problem. The Hamiltonian would definitely commute at a space like. Yeah. So that does not happen. So this will be nice. If I can show you this commutator vanish, that'd be nice. Okay. Well, I'm gonna write down the result and hopefully you agree it's this. because the answer is it doesn't happen. So I feel that I don't have to write more lines to show it. So when I do the commutator, use and v is still there, the exponential gets combined. Commutator of annihilation and the creation operator gave me some delta exactly cancel the one of the momentum integral. This thing, in principle, it doesn't vanish. In practice, it also doesn't vanish. Because you remember, you do that, you did this in scalar field theory. In dense part, you have a computer phi plus and a phi minus, and I realize, yeah, it doesn't vanish. So, what do? You're like, oh, your field is so great, it makes Hamiltonian Lorentz invariant, it makes only one delta in your potential, but you actually violate the causality, so what's good for you? Same technique. Things who do not satisfy our requirement, if as long as you have more than one thing, you have this freedom to tweak them. If you have two things, you can already add them together, subtract them together. If you have the infinite of them, you can integrate them over. What I'm talking about is, say, in dance course, you must have you that a phi and the phi actually, the scalar field of phi and the phi actually commute at space time. Did he do that? Did Dan tell you that the phi and the phi actually commute at a space-like separation? Yeah? Seems we need to review it. It's okay. We will review that. Okay, so you have phi plus, phi minus. The commutator doesn't vanish at a space-like separation. It's totally possible he didn't cover it. It's one of the topics that he might not. But the point is, all we need is I can build some linear combination. Such that my linear combination commutator, all anti-commutator will be zero at a space-like separation. Okay, so the annihilation and the creation fields themselves definitely does not vanish at a space-like. But turns out, I can tweak them, find them combination, and as long as the linear combination satisfy the condition, we satisfy the causality. So this we'll elaborate on Friday. On Friday, I want to show you how exactly I use this condition, which is basically our new causality condition, to show you why, when you promote your coefficient into operator, you don't get extra factor of 2 here, factor of pi there. No, they have to be proportional to each other. But that's advertisement for Friday. And so I post the first version of the homework 2. Basically involves you working on this to show me that Dirac field has to take the anti-commutator, which is very significant result. But you don't have to do it. The other version, the homework, is the Hamiltonian of the Dirac field. If you have done some version of the second, I recommend you to do the first one. It's very satisfying. See how this gives you Dirac field that has anti-commutator. Okay, so some advertisement. So we're gonna see this more carefully on Friday. And if you want to really see the how it just get out the anti-commutator and the commutator really doesn't work, you will have to do the first version of homework too. And the other version of homework 2 will be posted next Monday. So you will still have a whole week to work on. All right. The first two results, they just say, field works, don't worry. If you introduce this field, all the requirement of the special relativity will be satisfied. Some of them you have to, I don't know, twitch your arm to do it. But it'll work. This one though comes as a completely a surprise. Says it's the reason for antiparticles. And this gets back to us this promoting, right? How do you know sometimes you promote to be one operator to be A, the other to be A dagger, but sometimes you do A and B dagger. Why the difference, right? Okay, let me translate this one. It says, if a particle has charge Q, then I must be able to find a particle charge minus Q. That's what we mean by. So antiparticle definitely exist. Why? Okay, so let's continue trying to define this to make it crystal clear. What do we mean by charge, right? Charge says if you have a charge that's conserved, it says this charge must be commuted with your Hamiltonian. I think you learned this from classical physics. Okay, but now I'll put that aside and show you what do we mean by saying a dagger carry charge Q. So we're going to step back to quantum mechanics a bit to show what does this mean. This means whenever they make a statement that is a statement of observation, the answer is always, I use Q to observe the state, and I find charge Q. Yeah, this is completely quantum mechanics. No field yet. This is a definition. Okay, so that's for a one particle state, but what about I already have some number of particles and they together carry a charge Q alpha. Then we say, now you throw this charge in, what should come out? I have a particle has charge Q. I have a multi-particle state has a Q alpha. If I add the Q alpha state, I create a charge particle that is Q. What would be the total charge?
Sum.
If there's any, this makes sense. Okay, from now, we can compute the commutator. Yeah, I have QA dagger, and I have the A dagger Q. So let me show you that a Q and A dagger acting on alpha will give me QA dagger acting on alpha minus A dagger Q acting on alpha. And QA dagger gives me Q plus Q alpha, and then Q alpha is removed. We just have Q left. And we have A dagger. Yes. Because alpha is very general, so there must be a operator relationship. And now we can take a Hermitian conjugate of this, and we know we are going to get the A annihilation operator because they are the adjoint of each other. So it says a dagger will have a charge Q. It's like, see, this is like the letter operator, right? That a dagger will create a Q, A will destroy a Q. Okay. But the thing is, this is all very good. And the question is, how come A dagger A cannot be all that is? Because this A dagger is the creation of particle. A is the annihilation of the particle. Why do we necessarily want something else? So let's come back to this Hamiltonian, the Q commute thing. It says Q and some field must give me some definitive Q. So let me show you that, for example, the Hamiltonian, how the Hamiltonian and the Q commute will give us that. And I'll take a super simple Hamiltonian. It just has some field carry a plus charge, some field carry a minus charge. If the Hamiltonian actually, like, it's the charge conservation, I can't just take two charge cube. If the field have a two charge Q, then it can't make a Hamiltonian. You have to make Hamiltonian with opposite charge and they cancel. So if I do this problem, I have two commutator I want. And see this, if this this proportion to chi minus, this proportion to chi plus, you can hope each line is chi plus, chi minus, chi plus, chi minus, they can cancel. If this is something completely different, this is something completely different, then they're not going to cancel. So this is a requirement for Q to be a conserved charge, is each field that is made of the operator must have a definite charge. And what's our field made of? It's made of the creation field and annihilation field. Okay, but we just said the creation field is going to carry charge Q. The annihilation field is going to carry minus Q. So this doesn't work. So if you write this as Q acting on this, you're going to get a Q for the plus guy, but a minus Q for the annihilation field. And this is not going to get back something that looks like the field. So So what's our solution? What's our solution? We want the field has a definite charge so that it will commute with the Hamiltonian, and that will make our charge actually a conserved charge. But whatever we have right now is that the creation field is going to have positive charge and the annihilation field is going to have minus charge. It makes sense. You have a charge Q, and if you destroy that charge Q, it's like a minus Q. It's like they are fighting. So this is based on the analysis. We have a dagger. This thing creates charge Q, a particle that carries charge Q. And this A annihilates charge Q. So I think you have seen the complex scalar field. So what's the solution? The solution is saying this, maybe this is like A-type particle. And this is a B-type particle. But the B-type particle has exactly the opposite charge. So this would work Q chi L, but the chi L actually contains both A and B. And the Q is the one created. And the minus Q is chi L minus, which tells us A created charge Q, but B dagger actually create charge minus Q, but the annihilation field will create charge Q. It's like destroying a minus Q is like create a charge Q. So B and A dagger actually created the same amount of charge, and we are going to combine those to make our field. So argument is with only one type of particles, you never have the conserved charge to start with. Okay, so there are some successes of the field. We're going to dig into this point a little more, and I can explain why the plane wave come out. That's not an assumption. And I'll write you some equation. And I'll try to solve it on Friday. And what I will actually do on Friday is to actually build the scalar field that you know and love. But you realize during the building time, the only thing I assume is it transforms trivially. That's the assumption. And because it transforms trivially, as we know SU2, transform trivial is J equals 0. And then there's a long and a winding computation. We'll try to calculate the commutator and anti-commutator of phi and the phi, and we'll discover its commutator. We'll discover that the field we build is a boson. It's not an assumption. And I will show you the Weinberg's trick to how to attempt to solve the next one, which is the spin 1/2. And in the spinner representation, which spinner representation is probably the most important representation for our course, because after all, the rest of the course is all about the Dirac field, which transform in spinner transformation. And that's our goal of the tutorial in the tomorrow. And so if you follow the homework, no, I really don't think the first version homework is Landseer calculation. It has many pages because I will try to summarize what we did. And the calculation is similar lens. But if you follow that calculation, you'll realize that all you start is, I know there is a spinner representation of Lorentz. That's your starting point. And you will see spin 1/2 pop out on Friday's lecture. And that the tutorial is really to push through and to show that Dirac spinner is a fermion. So there's something I think you heard of from Dan's course called the spin statistics theorem. And I have never seen better, more beautiful proof than that one. It literally says spinner representation, once chosen, it is a spin half and it is a fermion. And because SU2 has all this beautiful build-up, says any spin of SU2 is built from spin 1/2. It basically proved for the whole theory. So, no, I just feel that you don't want to see that equation at the last 10 minutes of your lecture. So I decided to do some forecasts on tomorrow's tutorial and on Friday's lecture. And on Friday, we'll conclude this whole thing. We have field, we know how to build a field, the field is built, and I will start the new chapter of Dirac spinner. What I can say is if you're not happy with your understanding of the first 2 weeks, that's fine, unless you volunteer, I wouldn't interview on that. So you can see the interview questions doesn't have the first 2 weeks of material. But God, if I ask you how many generator SU2 have, you'd better know how to answer to that question. Because we're coming back for that in QFT2. And if you are not comfortable with the understanding, that's okay, these are tough material. But next week we'll start a new chapter, which hopefully, I'm trying to go for the effect that I'm going to just give you a copy of what Dan gave you.